Commander Repard, reel 26. Now, the first thing I'd like to do is actually, what exactly was your role as Commander Procurement? Obviously, we know what your friends thought, and you've said it was to get information on your on the King's enemies, or Queen's enemies.
Queen's enemies, yeah.
How exactly did you go about that, as far as you can tell us?
I was part of a very large team obtaining information on the Queen's enemies, of course, one of which has become considerably greater public knowledge about it, was the government communications headquarters down at Cheltenham, which in effect was intercepting the enemy communication, potential enemy communications all around the world, and rather, as were the much better publicized wartime events at Bletchley Park, trying to decode some of it. And there was the Foreign Office briefings, they had input as well. There were naval attaché briefings, and one of my roles was to keep in touch with naval attachés and this sort of thing. And therefore I had use of the diplomatic bags to send and receive information, and indeed to have a hand in developing the sort of camera equipment which they might usefully have available for the tasks they were doing. Many of the attachés, as they always had done, travelled extensively in the countries they were living in. And this sometimes, but they travelled with their wives whenever possible, because this was a better way of doing it. And they did nothing which was illegal. On the other hand, we had to use a diplomatic bag to send them some vital equipment. And I thought this sounded terribly exciting until I found that one of the bits of vital equipment I was required, for example, to send to the naval attaché in Russia, who had a wife, was a large pack of paper loo seats, because the places in which he travelled were sometimes rather different to the Western loo facilities provided. And I thought it vastly amusing that one of my jobs included providing paper loo seats. One of my predecessors in the role, who'd left the services, had a great urge to continue semi-espionage work, and we disowned him. And he was eventually bailed out in Russia because the Russians used two-way, any one-way glass and cameras and everything else. He was provided with various women and thoroughly enjoyed that, and then the whole lot was sent back to us, and they had all the films and all the descriptions of what he'd been doing, and in effect, please keep this chap out of our hair. So there were curiously interesting things of that sort. One of the people who'd been involved in that sort of work before and came into my life again much later was a chap who became the chairman of ICI, who'd been a regular naval officer and had had a job in intelligence just after the end of the war. And he was, in fact, working in northern Germany at that time, I think, before he left the service. And he'd written a book about it. It was immensely exciting on one occasion to be given a task to see if I could find some way of discovering the frequency of a new gunnery radar or missile radar, which we thought might have been being deployed. And I discovered that the ship in which it was being deployed was likely to be transferring from one of the Russian fleets to another. In the course of the transfer, it was likely to come within range. And I was also told that I only had 3 days in which to set up an operation which might obtain this information. And what I did was to find out that the RAF could provide a long-range aircraft, and if we could frighten the ship to the point it would turn on its radar, then we had to have some device in the aircraft which could in fact intercept this frequency and say what it was. But also they had to do it in such a way that they were not going to cause a major incident and get shot down or something ghastly like that. I also found that this was so secret that I certainly couldn't talk to everybody about it by any means, but I needed someone who could get approval from the other ministries, because In addition to setting up the operation, I had to get on the same piece of paper the signatures of the First Lord of the Admiralty, the First Sea Lord, the Civil Lord of the Admiralty, of course, the Foreign Secretary, the Minister of Defence, and the Prime Minister. And two of these gentlemen were in Europe. So I found a very, very knowledgeable, effective, and highly cleared from the security point of view civil servant who said, oh, that's all right, I'll get my friend in the Air Ministry and my friend in the Foreign Office and my friend at number 10 to set this up. Meanwhile, you go ahead planning the operation. So having got the Air Ministry to say they would provide the sort of long-range aircraft we had at that time, and the boffins to provide the necessary black box to put in it to intercept the radar, my chum arranged for an aircraft to take the bit of paper on which the signatures were being collected by very fast means to the particular countries where the overseas where the ministers happened to be. And the local diplomats arranged a car to take this highly secret thing off to them to sign and explain it to them. And I had to have the aircrew in the aircraft and the engines warming up before approval actually was received, within about an hour or two to go. And the operation did go ahead with the approval of all these great men, and we did in fact come away with a frequency at the end of it. This extremely exciting and rather hair-raising operation was a one-off as far as I was concerned, and I think very wisely a one-off, because we were dicing with all sorts of diplomatic problems if it had gone wrong. On the other hand, we did need to know rather more about the fleet which we could see being built in North Russia and in South Russia, because you may remember the Americans had very high-flying airplanes available at that time, and I had therefore access to photographs of the Russian shipyards where these new ships were being built and where the masses of submarines were being built as well. And so the threat, which is always part of the analysis one has to make, was becoming more and more available to us. And Admiral Gorshkov, I think his name was, who was the head man in the Russian Navy, was quite clearly causing a major imbalance between the balance of power at sea if all these things went to sea. And indeed, we used offensively, as we so scared pink they would be. So it added a certain edge to the job that I was doing, a very lowly job in this whole setup. But at one point, in order to give me a feel for what was going on with other services, I was sent to do a day's course with the Funnies in London. The Funnies, I subsequently found out, was in fact MI6. And it was charming, and I was told, broadly speaking, what the basic tradecraft was that one had to follow in certain circumstances abroad. And then they said, "Would you? We think we ought to give you a chance to practice this. We've told you how to take photographs clandestinely, and we'd like to give you a chance to do so. Now, here is a very tiny camera you can get into your breast pocket underneath your handkerchief, and you can learn very quickly in the loo next time you're there how to pop it up, take a photograph, and put it down again under your handkerchief. And we'd like you to take pictures of Discovery and one of the other ships alongside the Thames. And we haven't got much money, oh boy, so don't jump in and out of taxis or that sort of thing, but walk down there if you wouldn't mind and walk back again." So I did this, and I did all the funny things, like looking in the windows of shops to see if I was being followed, and occasionally changing direction to go and look at another shop window. And in due course, I got back to the place where I was doing my course, and they said, "Did everything go right?" And I said, "Yes, I think so. I didn't take any taxis or anything." Like, "Oh, no, boy, no, we really couldn't afford that. Look, while we're developing your photographs, you might like to look at these." So they took my camera away and disappeared, and they gave me the prints on a large board of me at every stage of what I'd been doing. And I realized that I was just the electric rabbit for a whole lot of pros practicing in a real training course. And I hadn't seen one of them. I was hugely impressed and felt a blithering idiot. So there were amusing things that happened as well. And eventually the job came to an end. One of the more interesting...
Anything else you remember about it? I know you can't tell us everything that went
on. No, I think something which perhaps there's no security attached to was the secretary who served both me and my captain. Suddenly took to turning up at my hockey matches at weekends as well. And Peggy often came down to them. And she, Miss Parker, was always very reluctant to come in and have tea. And as we played hockey in filthy cold weather, she would be freezing outside. And eventually Peggy had to go out and drag her in to come. And it was really quite embarrassing because clearly she was potentially a security risk.
So how long were you there, Paul?
I was there until, there will be a slight pause when I find out. I appointed to Belfast at Devonport, 13th of October, 1958, and as executive officer on commissioning, date to be reported. Well, I had no idea what that meant, because I had no idea that she would in fact be still in Devonport nearly a year later. We didn't sail until the ship was complete. So I joined a ship which had no sailors, dockyard mateys crawling all over her, the turrets were on the jetty, the masts were being rebuilt, everything had been refurbished from scratch. And the old hammock nets, hammock sleeping arrangements had been thrown out in favour of bunks for all sailors, and every sailor had his own reading light, and I found this the most astonishing revolution. On the other hand, we had to find somewhere to live. And so we charged down there to try and find out anything we could afford. And after many difficulties, we did take over a house called Pamphlet, which was so superb, we thought we couldn't possibly afford it. And we met the owner, called Mildmay White. And we found that this was their second lovely house there. They had a gorgeous house too. And they said they thought it might be £8 a week. Well, as we had eight bedrooms and umpteen bathrooms and the servants' wing and a retired naval officer living in the house next door who provided the gardeners, and we had our own private beach and a tennis court, and we never paid more than £3.50 for a house before, so it was more than double our outgoings. And they said, well, could they help by sending the children to school in Plymouth? And the chauffeur would pick them up, and they'd send the ponies around for us to ride, and so on. So we were absolutely in gorgeous, gorgeous home.
And what was your job? You were the executive officer.
I was appointed executive officer, but with no sailors, etc. So I was then responsible for the knitting the ship together again under dockyard control and making certain that we would try and meet the date on which the thing was meant to be ready. And as dockyards and so on don't always work flat out under those conditions, the ship in fact turned out to be 3 months late in the end. But the captain was only appointed about 3 weeks before we commissioned. So I gradually had the officers coming down. I had some of the senior ratings being appointed in the right sort of sequence. And it was immensely interesting and incredibly hard work to try and work mentally, work myself into the business of being part of a dockyard, part of a naval barracks, handling people ashore. I found that some of my Chinese staff, paid by the Queen, were being provided. They provided the officers, cooks, and stewards, about 40 or 50 official Chinese on board. I consulted two previous commanders of Belfast, who had been there in the Far East, and asked what I did about the flood of the applications I got within a couple of days of my appointment coming out, from Chinamen who wished to provide the service of laundry boys, tailors, shoemakers, and so on. And I had no idea what the drill was, because I'd never served in the Far East before.
You knew you were going to the Far East.
I knew I was going to the Far East station as the flagship of the Far East. And I found a wide variation in the advice I got, because I also knew that nearly all the Chinese either expected or asked for bribes, or squeeze, as it was called, or offered you all sorts of incentives to take them on. And one of the commanders I took on said, don't touch any of it. Queen's regulations are absolutely clear-cut. No way must you do anything. Another one said, well, it's jolly difficult to stop them giving you presents, you know, oh boy, but moderation in all things. And the other one said, good, oh, I'd like to go back there again. So I had to find some halfway house for this. The team of laundry boys for the whole ship's company who applied through a chap who signed himself R. Lee arranged to bring 8 of his laundry boys to Plymouth in about a year's time, and I put some date down out of the top of my head. And because of all the excitement going on with the commissioning approaching and the end of the dockyard work, I clean forgot to tell them that we'd been delayed 3 months. So I was rung up by the immigration authority in the Thames somewhere, who said, we've got 8 Chinamen here who say they're coming to work for you, but they haven't got any immigration papers. So I gulped a bit and said, that's all right, I'll send 2 Royal Marines down and a Corporal of Marines to take charge of them and bring them back and sign for them if necessary. That'll be good enough for you. Thank heaven the chap said, yes, it would. And so we had 8 Chinamen come down, and while they were on passage from the Thames down to Devonport, I went to the barracks organization, the commander of the barracks, and said, oops, I've got this thing happening. Can you accommodate them? And he said, oh, yes, sir, I'll put you on to the supply officer here. So the commander of supply in the barracks said, yes, I'll take them on. Tell them I'll give them the run of their teeth in return for preparing vegetables. So I thought that was a great relief. They had the Chinaman there for about 24 hours when my chief cook, Chief Petty Officer Kwok, the chief wardroom cook, came to me and said, in great agitation, and said, could he speak to me? And he explained to me that the laundry boys had come to him, as he spoke better English than they did, and they were laundry boys, not cook boys, and therefore they couldn't possibly prepare vegetables. That would be awful. So I thought, well, I perhaps sort this out. And I knew there was in Devonport or Plymouth, there was a Chinese restaurant. And I thought that they'd find work down there. So I suggested that. And they went down there, and I darn nearly started a Tong War down in the West Country as a result, because they were the wrong sort of Chinese for some reason. I didn't really understand. So I talked to Peggy about it, and we got the officers together who were gradually assembling and said, how many can you take into your house? We're taking 2. And so Chi and Lee came to live with us, and the other officers took the rest of them off the problem. And Chi and Lee lived in this gorgeous great house with us in the servants' quarters. And there was only one curious feature about it. They wouldn't eat our food, or at the times we did. They ate twice a day. And every time we took any clothes off, they were immediately laundered, all produced in exactly rectangular shape, and appeared on the draining board almost before we'd taken them off. And after a month or two of this, I suggested they'd been working awfully hard, and really I felt they ought to have some time off. And I was quite happy to give them a chance to go on a bus ride to Dartmouth and see the local sights and give them a few meals out and so on. Horrors. Chief Cook wanted to see me again the next day. Problem. They think you are sending them away and their work is no good. It is criticism of them that you're sending them away. So I said, no, Chief, I'm trying to give them a break. They've been working their backsides off. They want to work for you. They feel they owe you this. You have been their host at home. So I got hold of these two and said, right, start cleaning the windows and wash the car and do all the rest of it. And they were happy as Larry. So much so that out in Hong Kong later on, they wished to return the hospitality that I'd shown them, which was so generous, and gave me the most monumentally horrifying dinner I've ever had in my life. And I had to bring another officer, and I brought the engineer commander with me. And we had dinner, jumping ahead a bit, but we had dinner in a tenement block where on each floor there were 30 families, but only two cooking facilities, one at each end where there was a balcony. And one of the balconies had been taken over so they could give us dinner. They brought in the shoemaker as well as the laundry boys because he spoke better English than they did. And we had to drink toasts between each of 12 courses in cooking whiskey. And it was a formidable challenge, but we kept the flag flying throughout.
So you were on the, when exactly did the was the Belfast ready? Do you know what date?
I will in a moment if you give me time to find it. Belfast commissioned on Tuesday the 12th of May 1959 at 11 o'clock in the morning.
Do you remember the ceremony?
Was a service which was used in asking the blessing of Almighty God upon Her Majesty's ship Belfast. The service conducted by the chaplain of the fleet, the Venerable Archdeacon Bunt, the Reverend Eric Milner, and the Reverend R.G. Williams, who was the Church of Scotland and Free Church's chaplain, and the Anglican chaplain we were going to have on board as well, in the presence of Captain J.V. Wilkinson, D.S.C. G.M.R.N., who was the captain who had been appointed only 3 weeks before.
Now, what were your first impressions of Captain J.V. Wilkinson?
That he was my captain, and I was absolutely determined to please him because I had only a very narrow chance, as this was my seagoing chance, to be promoted to captain, or be recommended for promotion to captain. I'd never met him before. He was a few years older than I was, and he'd never been second in command of anything. He was promoted from whatever it was to command of frigates or small ships during the war. And had obviously done very well, extraordinarily well.
What was he like?
Tall, thin, and not easily approachable. Distant to me, really all the time. And no matter what I did, I was faintly worried, so I concentrated on getting the best possible ship's company. And I have a photograph of the ship's company actually marching on board the ship on the 12th of May. It was.
How could you go about getting the best ship's company? Surely they were just drafted to.
They were drafted. They arrived in a heap. Some of them I'd known for a bit because the senior ratings were appointed to the barracks first and had familiarized themselves with the ship. And we had to prepare the ship for people to sleep on board, of course, in heaps, and they had to be issued with hammocks and all the other things. So I had to rely initially upon the senior ratings, and I was absolutely determined to get to know the ship's company as soon as I could, and I'd appointed the gunnery officer to run my office, which was a sort of executive mate of the upper deck type of job, and I had the seaman divisional officers of the forecastle, top and quarter deck, and the various junior officers who were attached to them. In the wardroom, we had nearly 50 people. And by the time we had the Admiral staff in the Far East, it was just over 50. So we were aiming to be the flagship of the Flag Officer Second in Command Far East, and we had to take the ship off, and it had been very substantially modified. And we had to work her up from scratch.
What do you remember of the working up trials?
Working up trials were done.
Where were they done at?
We set off to Portland to do that. And we came back to Plymouth to fire the guns too, at towed targets. And I found that, rather surprisingly, we had a case of gross indecency with two young sailors appropriated down in the double bottoms of the ship, which caused everybody to laugh a bit. And they had to be court-martialed. And the captain took the ship to sea and left me with his secretary to conduct the court-martial and to prosecute, in effect. And the system provided these two young sailors with a barrister to defend them. So I found myself up against a barrister in a very formal court of law. So I spent a lot of time reading the books up beforehand to find out how to date. And the captain, by chance, had the most awful troubles at sea because something went wrong with the gunnery and they had straddled the tug as opposed to hitting the target at night. So he came back absolutely determined to crucify the gunnery officer about all that. I got a conviction for these things. And I made several mistakes in the course of prosecuting. I was leading witnesses. The barrister was jumping up and down and saying, I object the whole time, in order to try and put me off. But when the court agreed with me that they were indeed guilty, he took me out to lunch after and said, terribly sorry I had to do all that thing. The best way of doing it was to try and put you off so you would make a cock of it. Well done, in effect. So it was all very human. One of my worries was that the ship's bell, which was hung on the after screen on the quarterdeck, was solid silver and had been presented to the ship by Chamberlain, the Prime Minister's wife, in 1939 when Belfast first commissioned and was built in Northern Ireland. And I was terrified that I'd arrive down one morning and find a chunk out of the bell, of course. Luckily, it never actually happened. But the bell is still on board, I see. It's now part of your museum rather than my worry anymore.
How had the ship changed, would you say? Because wasn't it the same class as the Sheffield?
No, she was bigger and longer than the Sheffield. Belfast and Edinburgh were longer and heavier, of course. Sheffield, I think, was 10,000 tons, and this was 12,500 or thereabouts, in that order of magnitude. But one of the worries we had when we had to take her out first of all was, had the stability been changed by any of the differences made in the structure? And so we had to take her out and do heeling trials off Portland Bill. And securing her to a buoy there and heeling her over more and more and finding out how much water we could transfer from one side to the other, how much fuel from one side to the other, did actually trigger a report, a formal report from some other ship to say that Belfast was sinking. Caused minor stirs, as you would imagine.
Was it stable?
Oh, yes, it was very reasonably stable. But I rediscovered my facility for being seasick in everything I'd ever been to sea in. Because we were in the middle of trials when we were told to make the best speed possible, proceed with the utmost dispatch, I think was the wording, down to the Bristol Channel, where one of the V-bombers had disappeared. And we had to go down into a head sea as fast as we possibly could. And I thought I was sick, but going through the mess decks and in the passageways and all the rest of it, the brand new ship's company was so horribly sick, I'd never seen anything like it in my life. They had to get the hoses connected up and wash through the ship from one end to the other. And there was no trace of the V-bomber, unfortunately, at the end of it either.
It had ditched, had it?
It had ditched somewhere, disappeared at sea.